Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 9th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times, or rather joining us on the line from the Cape Cod Times this morning is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and check in with Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. Patrick, the Cape and Islands have yet to see a medical marijuana dispensary opened here. Medical and recreational marijuana very much at the forefront of town planning and regulation efforts these days. This week, the state's Cannabis Control Commission held a hearing on the Cape looking for input. What did they hear?
Well, they heard mixed input, I would say. There were people who showed up at this hearing at Barnstable Town Hall who said that things weren't, that the draft regulations that the Cannabis Control Commission had put together for marijuana, recreational marijuana primarily at this point, went too far in terms of they're too strict, and some said even stricter than what's applied to the alcohol industry. Others argued for stricter rules. So again, there was a mixed bag of input here. This is part of a process that the Cannabis Control Commission is going through. They've done hearings prior to drafting these regulations, and they're supposed to come up with final regulations by March 15th. Again, anytime they're going through this process with medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, it's taken some time. Public has until February 15th to comment on the draft regulations. Some of the other interesting things to come out of this hearing at Barnstable Town Hall, some things we've heard before, farmers in particular were represented, and they pointed out that they thought that some of the regulations were more geared towards big growers, big kind of industry type growers versus small growers, and they asked for some changes there. But again, there were other people in the audience who said that they believed that these regulations should be essentially scrapped and start again from square one, and that they should be stricter. And there were concerns about young people having access to marijuana in some of these cafe type areas that they're talking about establishing, that somebody 18 years old could work there, even though the state law restricts marijuana use to adults 21 years and older. The Governor Baker had weighed in on that this week, saying he also thought the Cannabis Control Commission was going too far in terms of trying to do cafes and theaters and movie theaters and things like that where this marijuana could be used, instead of just focusing on kind of the basic aspects of opening retail shops for the sale of marijuana.
So again, these are the draft regulations. The public has until February 15th to comment on these. We heard this week about proposals on the federal level to open the waters off the New England coast to oil and gas exploration. Tell us about this.
Yeah, these were proposals that actually came up last month at the beginning of January. The Trump administration has certainly been pushing for more gas and oil exploration off the coasts. And in, I think, January 4th, they floated this idea of opening up the Atlantic coastline to more of that type of exploration. People up and down the Atlantic coast in different states pushed back, and the environmentalist fishermen and state governments are basically opposing that idea, including here in Massachusetts. In particular, here in Massachusetts, it's the kind of North Atlantic planning area which they're worried about. The Obama administration, at the end of their administration, invoked a 1953 law basically saying that there was permanent protection from drilling to the continental shelf from Virginia to Maine. And this is essentially a rollback of that would occur. And of course, fishermen and other interests are worried about the potential effects of drilling, whether it be the seismic activity that occurs as they're exploring or whether it be from an oil spill. The Attorney General here in Massachusetts has weighed in as well, pushing back and pointing out the amount of tourism and fishing industry dollars that are produced off the coast of Massachusetts, and again, concerns about what would happen if something went wrong with an oil spill off of our coast.
But energy advocates kind of pushing back and saying that there's opportunities here for jobs and industry and to contribute to the United States energy use around the world.
Yeah, the International Association of Drilling Contractors cited a U.S. Energy Information Administration estimate that there would be a 48% growth in worldwide energy demand over the next 20 years, and said that there's a lot of recoverable resources out there and that would produce new jobs and billions of dollars in investment. So obviously they're taking a different tact on it from, say, the fishing groups and the environmental groups.
It's interesting, I thought, that you're reporting that all the governors of the coastal states are opposed to this idea.
Yeah, and your listeners may remember the governor of Florida, I believe, got an exemption pretty quickly for his state, and it was one of those things that happened, and people pointed out and said that that was kind of favoritism little bit, and all the other governors up and down the coast said, you know, we'd like that exemption as well, including here in Massachusetts.
Before we move on from ocean management, you had a story about some protections voted into place last week for deep sea coral off New England coastlines.
Yeah, this is the New England Fishery Management Council. They had actually voted also to send a letter opposing the offshore oil and gas drilling as well, or the exploration that they were proposing there. But they also last week voted to protect deep sea coral from the effects of fishing across this pretty large area of ocean about 100 miles south of Nantucket. Now, this is an area where there's not a whole lot of fishing of this type going on. It's very deep water, but it is a large area. It's 25,000 square miles, and combined with a couple of other areas up and down the coast, it totals about 100,000 square miles of the Atlantic continental shelf that would be protected from essentially trawlers and the type of fishing that affects these corals. This isn't here in the North Atlantic. In any case, this isn't the type of coral that you think of when you think of a coral reef. It's more kind of individual plants and things like that. But there are some kind of fascinating creatures down there, and obviously it's all part of this big ecosystem. And they're also very delicate, so any sort of jostling or any sort of activity that would affect those corals could be damaging. And these are things that grow for, you know, a long time, so it would take a long time for them to regrow. The Fishery Management Council decided that it was just the better part of valor to kind of make that off limits to most fishing. There's one exemption for the red crab fishery, which has relatively few participants. But other than that, you wouldn't be able to do the types of, again, trawling and that type of fishing in this area. It's way off the coast, and it's an area that's really hard to get to and access for fishing in any case.
Let's speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
An iconic island bakery and late-night stop has been sold, but it sounds like the new owners plan to keep up the tradition. Tell us about this.
That's what I've been told. Yeah, as you said, there's been a sale of a pretty beloved spot, which is Martha's Vineyard Gourmet Cafe and Bakery, which is offers everything from wedding cakes to donuts. But more importantly to some, at night, it's the home of Backdoor Donuts, where out the back door, starting at about 7 at night, they offer up hot, fresh apple fritters and maple bacon donuts and a whole menu, and it's very popular. People will wait in line for, you know, sometimes pretty long time because it's very popular. And we learned this week that, as you said, it's under new ownership. That when the bakery reopens in April, it's going to be owned by a new ownership group, which actually is a pretty interesting group. It includes Richard Friedman, who's a longtime seasonal Edgartown resident. He actually owns a home on Oyster Pond, which was the summer White House for the Clintons when they came to the island during summer vacations when they were in the White House. And he owns the Charles and the Liberty Hotels in Boston. So he's one of the new owners. Another new owner is Patrick Lyons, who has a house in Chilmark, and he's a well-known Boston businessman who owns a lot of restaurants and nightclubs in Boston. And the third new owner is David Ginsberg, who is the vice chairman of the Boston Red Sox. So this group is now the new owner of this bakery, and they're buying it from the previous owners, Janice Casey and Rita Brown, who had owned it for about 17 years. Had kind of, in that time, this really turned into a destination for a lot of people in Oak Bluffs during the summertime. Even though it's not clear when exactly this backdoor tradition started. It has been a bakery for a long time before Janice Casey and Rita Brown bought it in 2001. And apparently there's been a tradition, maybe going back to the 1980s, of this backdoor sale, but it really has become popular in the last 15 years or so. But I've been assured by Janice Casey, one of the former owners, who is staying on. They're staying on for a year or so as consultants, you know, to assure a smooth transition. And she said the new owners really do plan to keep it the same way it has been, that the head pastry chef is going to stay on, and he's the one who's responsible for, you know, all these favorite treats. The new owner said they want to keep it as part of the vineyard community the same way it has been, except maybe invest in some new equipment to serve customers better and hopefully faster, is what they said. So maybe the line will get a little bit shorter. But otherwise, they said they don't plan on big changes.
Well, good news for folks who really cherish that place.
Yes, I heard from a lot of people, and we got a lot of comments who said their first reaction was, you know, is anything going to change? And what about the apple fritters? And I've been assured the apple fritters are going to stay are going to stay the same. So that's good news to a lot of people.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, back in December, we heard about a missing Mashpee man. This week, his son and his son's girlfriend charged in his death.
Yeah, this is Raymond Perry, who was 64 when he disappeared late November, early December. He was reported missing on December 1st. And his son, Eli Perry, and Eli Perry's girlfriend, Paige Malone, have been charged with his murder, with his killing at this point. They've been charged with the murder. The Perry and Malone, Eli Perry and Paige Malone, according to prosecutors, killed his father, Raymond Perry, in his Mashpee home and then drove off Cape with a pickup truck that they had taken from a nearby boatyard and left his remains, Raymond Perry's remains in Plymouth in a cranberry bog. So this took a little while to happen. Eli Perry was arrested back in December when he and Paige Malone were pulled over in Plymouth, and he's been held ever since then. But they were both arraigned this week on these new charges, including the murder charge and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and illegal disposal of a human body. So they were both ordered, you know, held without bail, and it'll go forward from here. But the prosecutors essentially laid out their case in court to start with, and there was more details that came out from an affidavit that got them to this point. Police said that they used cell phone tracking data that showed that they were in the area of the cranberry bog where the body was found. There was a surveillance video that they saw the Paige Malone and Eli Perry on in a couple different places. And there's this kind of timeline that they've set up in terms of the theory of the crime as far as prosecutors are concerned. The attorney for Paige Malone says that, you know, she's got a drug problem, but she's not, you know, a murderer. And the only evidence linking her to the incident is this Starbucks bottle that was found at the scene. And she had been seen on surveillance video at a gas station buying, you know, the same type of Starbucks coffee. And so he says that, you know, she wasn't the one who did it. He said that he believed Eli Perry was responsible for the killing. But the district attorney for the Cape and Islands, Michael O'Keefe, said they are equally responsible. In his eyes, this is a joint venture murder, he said. And so these are the allegations against them. And of course, we're going to continue to follow this story as it plays out.
And Eli Perry yesterday at his arraignment pleading not guilty, and his attorney making that point clear.
Yeah, he says he did not do it. He's been held in Plymouth County Correctional Facility since, again, being arrested back in December on other charges. But they are both being held at this point until the next court appearance.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone right now with us is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham Selectmen and a private group are working together on housing initiatives to try to alleviate some of Chatham's housing difficulties. This follows on a story we talked about last week about the controversy around a proposal for creating more accessory dwellings.
That's right, Steve. For the past 6 months, this group of private citizens has been meeting to try to get a handle on the local housing situation. And their aim is to promote and support not just affordable housing, but what they're calling attainable housing, basically housing for workers and professionals who make too much to qualify for affordable housing, but not enough to really afford the housing prices around here. The median house price last year in Chatham was about $637,000. So that's you got to make a lot more than the average salaries around here to attain that. So this week they met with the Board of Selectmen to discuss a range of strategies to start addressing these issues, which they say threatens the community character of Chatham, because one of the things that makes Chatham a desirable place is its diversity and its mix of workers and people and fishermen. And they say that the housing costs are threatening that, and that means it's threatening really the reasons that people have been buying houses here and subsequently, unfortunately, driving up the cost of houses. So one of the things they're proposing, one of their main goals, is to establish a nonprofit organization that can sort of act as a go-between and buy reasonably priced housing when and if it comes on the market here, and hold it until the town or another entity can move to acquire it and pass it on to qualified buyers. Now, the town can't act really quickly. You have to go through town meetings, selectmen have to approve expenditures, but a private organization could move quickly to buy up those type of properties. It's similar to what the town now works with the local conservation land trust to identify and sort of hold properties until the town can get them when they come on the market or they become available. Now, apparently Nantucket has a similar program like this, and they're really looking at that closely as a model. Now, another one of the things they're looking at is home rule legislation that would increase the town's area median income designation, which would raise the level of income that would allow people to qualify for certain types of housing. And they're also working to support the town on the accessory dwelling unit bylaw, which is now undergoing review before it comes back after being sort of criticized by a number of people during a recent hearing. And they're also going to support a number of efforts that the town is working on to get community preservation funds to, among other things, hire a housing coordinator who would work full-time on the issue of housing in town. And that position is proposed to be shared with the town of Harwich, and officials are talking about how that's going to work at this point. Selectmen agreed to all these efforts, and that was the assurance that this private group needed really to move ahead with their plans.
So a lot of ideas there to try to move this forward and make some attainable housing more available for folks.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the people in this group say, you know, there's not one solution that's going to fix this problem, and it's not a local problem. It's, as we know, it's a region-wide problem. But they're worried that Chatham's going to become like a bedroom community. They say you can already see it in the morning if you're on the road around 7-8 o'clock, traffic going into town, people coming into jobs here to work here at the shops and different positions is a lot heavier than people leaving town.
Hmm. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy is with us on the line from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, I want to talk about the opioid crisis. The number of overdose calls to emergency responders rose in 2017, even as the number of deaths from overdoses dropped.
Yeah, and this is something we've been hearing about in the last couple of years as being the case, and a lot of people point to the overdose drug to reverse overdoses, essentially. Narcan is what it's commonly known as. And essentially the availability of that has, they say, resulted in these lower fatal overdose numbers. While you may have more overdose calls, there are fewer people dying of these overdoses. And the numbers on the Cape, which our then reporter Casey Myers, who you're having on a little later on as the new editor at the Provincetown Banner, was reporting right before she left, the numbers on the Cape align with state numbers, which showed a drop by 10% in the first 9 months of 2017 of fatal overdoses compared with the same period in 2016. Total figures for 2017 aren't available yet, but folks who are in this, field in terms of overdose prevention, again, point to the number of programs and resources that have been geared towards trying to prevent fatal overdoses, and saying that you know, that's one of the reasons here. But you know, there's always a caveat. Again, this increase in overdose calls means that this problem of people overdosing and people continuing to use heroin and fentanyl, again, in more numbers, is continuing to rise.
Number of overdose calls in Mashpee in 2017 doubled. That's an amazing number.
Yeah, and there were calls in Sandwich, Provincetown, Dennis, you know, in a bunch of different towns on the Cape that increased as well. But it is pretty amazing that number, as you said.
The reporter also spoke with an advocate who's been working to get naloxone, Narcan, into sober homes and in places in Falmouth, particular, and that advocate was saying that effort is part of the reason why they believe that the deaths have gone down.
Yeah, this is Kim Powers, the harm reduction specialist at AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, and she says that the reason the numbers are basically flat, at least flat, in places like Hyannis and Falmouth, where you had seen high numbers previously, or increasing numbers, they at least stayed flat, was because of the availability of this overdose reversal drug. But like you said, she's saying that there has to be more done to get this into sober homes, which is where a lot of people are really at risk. There's a high-risk population in early recovery who often relapse and overdose.
We're going to speak now with Josh Bolling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, what's the news from Nantucket?
Well, the news from Nantucket is that last year, more than $1 billion worth of real estate sold on the island. It probably doesn't surprise too many people who follow the Nantucket real estate market, but anytime you throw around numbers like that, it's pretty impressive, even though some real estate agents that I talked to said that $1 billion in sales now is the threshold, not the record. Pretty big deal, though. Everybody pretty much knows, though, that Nantucket real estate is expensive. So when you look at $1.07 billion in sales last year on about 550 transactions, it might not be a surprise. That money, though, did generate about $20.5 million for the Nantucket Islands Land Bank, which uses it to acquire open space for active and passive recreation. A 2% fee is charged on the majority of real estate transactions for that. Good news for island real estate agents, good news for the island economy, but not necessarily such good news for those in the workforce, those maybe moving to the island looking to start a life here, affording a home. The average home price last year was $2.37 million. That's up from $2.28 million. The median home price was $1.6 million. Mm. And that leaves out a lot of people trying to get into the market. The cheapest home on the market right now, detached single-family home on Nantucket, is $750,000.
Mm. Those 550 land transactions in the last year, those are how much of those are a private home? I mean, this is mostly
majority of those are homes. There was some vacant. There's not that much buildable vacant land left on Nantucket. One of the reasons that you know, real estate agents and islanders say that the prices are so high is that there's a lack of available buildable land, and that's the way the island wants it. More than half the island, or just about half the island, is in permanently protected open space, and that you know, doesn't leave too much left for the construction of homes. And you know, there's a number of initiatives underway to address the affordability, to build some affordable housing projects under 40B laws, under modified versions of the 40B law. There's a couple projects in the works right now, one under development, one in the approval process, to try and provide some homes to those who meet affordability guidelines at far less than the average in the mean prices. But those are still a little ways away, and those looking for housing in Nantucket are still finding a pretty hard go of it for the most part.
And you said $20.5 million to the land bank from all that transaction
last year?
From
those transactions,
yeah.
Yep. And it's 2% fee, so you just sort of do the math. $1 billion, that's about $20 million. So, yep, they use that to acquire open space, to maintain their properties they have, to pay the debt service on some of the bonds they've taken out over the years to buy open space. Most of what the land bank holds, again, all of it open to the public, either in active recreation like playing fields, or passive open space that is you know, traversed by trails, connects with other open space held by private nonprofits out here, so that they had a banner year as well, thanks to the big real estate year.
Josh Bolling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for filling us in on that.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times on the line with us. Patrick, an advocacy group, Conservation Law, is suing the federal government, saying it isn't doing enough to protect right whales. And this could have It's good to have implications for lobster fishermen.
Yes, obviously we've been talking about the plight of the North Atlantic right whale. It's a highly endangered species. They're only about 460, 450, you know, maybe even under that, depending on who you're talking to, left in the world. And the Conservation Law Foundation and a group known as Earth Justice have sued the National Marine Fisheries Service, saying they haven't been doing enough fast enough to try and alleviate the problems that have led to deaths among the North Atlantic right whales. This is the kind of second suit. Another similar suit was filed last month by the Defenders of Wildlife, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Center for Biological Diversity. But again, they're kind of both seeking to push the federal government to act quicker. And in particular, the lobster industry, federal regulators have said recently that they need to make changes to their gear to decrease their effect on the whales. A lot of this has to do with new technology that's being developed. Ropeless buoys and weaker whale-friendly rope is being developed now. But again, these groups are saying it's not happening fast enough. The lobster industry says that they've been doing everything they can to address this situation. And the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association in particular says that they're doing far more than anybody else to deal with this. So they kind of point to that and say, you know, we may not be the problem. There may be problems elsewhere. But here in Massachusetts, we're really working hard on this.
But it is the entanglement specifically that they're looking at there. And it seems as if much of those entanglements are coming from lobster traps and buoys.
Yes, they certainly are. We had the 18 whale deaths in the last year or so, 17, I think, maybe one unconfirmed. But they say that entanglement in fishing gear is now responsible for 85% of deaths, with ship strikes coming in a distant second. And again, one of the issues that's been raised here is kind of the long-term effects of repeated entanglements. We had a whale in the last week or so come up dead off the coast of Virginia. And again, this was a whale that had been repeatedly entangled, and that stress and that effect on the whale, you can imagine this large animal dragging around gear out in the ocean can have an effect. They say that the biological opinion that the National Marine Fisheries Service used really didn't take into account the right kind of factors in coming to their how they handle this situation.
And the technology is still a couple of years off, likely, that could bring ropeless technology, ropeless fishing to that industry. I want to speak now to Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
Casey, first, welcome to the program. Many folks probably familiar with your reporting at the Cape Cod Times. Congratulations on your new position at the Provincetown Banner.
Thanks again. I'm glad to be here.
This week marked the 20th anniversary of the Whalers Wharf fire right in the heart of Provincetown. You sent me a note saying it was the biggest response in terms of firefighters in Cape Cod history. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it was. So it started at 6:30 p.m. on a very quiet, windless, and mild night, thank goodness. In February 9th, 1998, and it just grew and grew and grew, and I was actually listening to the radio responses that were recorded. They're on YouTube somewhere, and you can hear the firefighters, the dispatcher out of Truro, first very calm, measured voice, and they never lost their calm and measured voice, but they kept saying more and more ominous things, like giving the address, then a pause, in the heart of the downtown, with a lot of buildings really close by. And the firefighter response was absolutely huge. I think there were over 350 firefighters there by the end of the evening.
Coming from all over the Cape.
Yes, all over the Cape, even off Cape.
And the fire, tell us about the structure that burned, because it was really iconic to the downtown.
It was iconic, and it was very large to the downtown as well. It was two buildings. It was the Whalers Wharf, and it was the Crown and Anchor. They're just very big buildings right in the heart of the downtown, like you said. They were also inches or just a few feet away from neighboring buildings. And when they started to go, it was the whole town was under threat, and people who were walking around that night who could get in close would describe it as kind of a weather event. You couldn't even tell what was on fire for a while. You couldn't even really see. One of the people that Katie Ward talked to said it was just kind of this glowing red ball, and it was that the ash was coming down like snow. It was just a different kind of scale. And even the firefighters who talk about it 20 years later say it was the fire of their career. They've just never seen anything like it.
Now, it destroyed these buildings there, but then part of this story is the fact that they were rebuilt and how they were rebuilt.
Yeah, they were rebuilt. The Whaler's Wharf was rebuilt with a great memory of the old building in terms of its size and also its spirit of housing artists and artisans. But it's really creative with the roof is not enclosed. It's kind of it's just this very creative space, and it was also built out of steel and not wood, which was key. And then the Crown and Anchor also, I'm not exactly sure how different the Crown and Anchor is, except that it's very, to me, it's very much the same, only kind of nicer.
And the Whaler's Wharf continues to, it houses many different little, smaller businesses, which offers something to the downtown.
It does, absolutely, yeah. I think part of the what made this fire so epic was, in a way, what happened afterwards, too. It was kind of, I mean, the four firefighters were summoned for looting, I believe. Was it four or six? And it was just really gut-wrenching after surviving the fire. The town was so grateful to the fire department, and then they were charged with looting, and it was another chapter of just basic sadness. And then it was finally capped off in the end by the man who felt responsible for the fire. He was staying at the Whaler's Wharf as the night watchman, and his space heater malfunctioned, and it caused the fire, and he blamed himself, and he killed himself. Within the same month of the fire. So by the end of that February, there was just not a lot of positive things to say at all. It was bad. And so it's what's so great about looking back at it 20 years later is that somehow the town did come through it and mended all their differences, and it's cool. It's kind of neat.
20 years ago, February 9th, that's 20 years ago today. Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, great. Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. This is like old home week following Casey Myers and on the radio with Patrick Cassidy. I love it.
Yes, we're outnumbered here at WCAI. George, the Chilmark Fire Station appears to have a number of problems, but perhaps chief among them is asbestos. Tell us about this.
That's right. Our reporter, Rich Salzberg, has had some really in-depth coverage of this, and I'm sure there's more to come on the asbestos issue at the Chilmark Fire Station. This all comes as the Chilmark Board of Selectmen is looking for a location for a new station, but that's years in the making. This is an issue where firefighters are concerned about being in the fire station for any length of time. They've known about asbestos at the fire station for about 20 years, but if it's contained, it's not really an issue. But there is some concern that the dust in the fire station may be asbestos related, and so now the Board of Selectmen has agreed to hire an outside firm to come in and do an evaluation of the station. We have a bunch of photos on our website.
They're very telling photos, I would say.
They are, and you know, it's just unbelievable, really, to see a fire station in this shape. It's cramped. That's only the beginning of it. the restroom facility. We said in an editorial this week that that would a porta potty makes that look. It makes a porta potty look glamorous. The restroom facility at this fire station. No one should have to use that type of facility. It's just in incredible shape. The fire station, and as we've reported, your listeners may remember, over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about this idea of a tri-town fire department that would join Chilmark, Aquinnah, and West Tisbury under one fire department. And we have sort of a late-breaking story that that's been discounted by West Tisbury. They're not interested in joining forces. So Chilmark is going to be on their own here to get a new fire station. But in the interim, what to do about this station that is in such bad shape and maybe a health hazard? We don't know for sure yet, but there is certainly some real concern in town.
Enough concern that the firefighters, as you reported in the article, they try to spend as little time as possible in there because they have concerns about the dust being asbestos.
That's right. There's something called the Tri-Town Ambulance Service, and they, you know, they're allowed to share this space. Obviously, they're providing emergency medical service to Chilmark, and they don't want to go in there. So that's pretty telling.
George, you have another great story we don't have time for right now, but I want to encourage folks to look at it. It's Barry Stringfellow's very colorful story on the creation of the original ice rink on Martha's Vineyard, which came over. It was a secondhand ice rink. You don't hear a story about a secondhand ice rink appearing that often.
No, absolutely. Check it out.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve, and take care.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, this week marked the 40th anniversary of a major storm hitting New England. It inflicted its share of damage on the Cape as well.
Yeah, this really is Old Home Week with George and Casey, the Cape Cod Times alumni out there, but also looking back on these instances and on the Whalers Wharf fire, just really quick, the anniversary is tomorrow, and we'll have a whole...
The 10th, okay.
Yeah, we'll have a whole package tomorrow looking back as well. I'm sure the Banners package is great, but we'll also have something in tomorrow's paper. But the blizzard of 78, everybody will remember that. It's, you know, the opposite of a fire. It was freezing snow in a lot of places and lots of it in a lot of places. Not so much here on the Cape. Here on the Cape, looking back at it, it was really the high winds, the storm surges, new moon, high tides that battered the region, severe coastal erosion, structural damage. And one of the big things was the outermost, what was known as the outermost house, made famous by author Henry Beston, was swept away by the raging seas. There's a lot of dramatic telling of that happening along the Cape Cod National Seashore. This was a long storm. There were a lot of high tide cycles. A lot of people died in the region. But again, here on the Cape, it was more the types of erosion and things that we see in a lot of these winter storms. Reporter Jeff Spillane went to an event last weekend at sponsored by the Blue Hill Observatory and Science Center, where there were a lot of the weathermen who were involved in looking at this storm when it first appeared on the radar, so to speak. And it's great because they talk about, you know, there was hand-drawn maps at that point. They were drawing the maps, so you can only imagine the kind of predictions that they were working with. But they say National Weather Service people say, you know, you wouldn't be as surprised by something like that today. There's better forecasting and more proactive approach to emergency management. But, you know, it still happens. 2007, employers in and around Boston were told to go home early, and it ended up with major gridlock as they were on the roads. And one of the things I thought was interesting, the record high water level for Boston Harbor occurred during the 78 storm. That was held up until just last month, where mm-hmm. the record high water level was there in Boston and flooded a lot of the seaport area. So it's amazing that a record held for that long from that storm.
I thought it was interesting in the article you point out that the same storm today as from 40 years ago would likely be more intense, the forecasters say, because of rising sea levels.
Yeah, and that's always something that comes up when you're looking at these storms. Is it caused by climate change? or isn't it? And I think one of the things that we've been hearing over the last several years, many years really, is the fact that it may or may not be caused, but it could be more intense. And again, a storm like that, you can kind of only imagine you bump up the sea level a little bit and you're going to have more flooding.
Andy Tomolonis is joining us now from SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, a story this week about a pair of fishing boats sinking at the New Bedford Pier. A lot of questions around this. One of the boats was involved just last week in a case where unreported scallops were discovered aboard.
Right. And these boats are boats owned by the cod father, Carlos Rafael. So, you know, Carlos is the fishing magnate from New Bedford who's currently serving almost a four-year term in prison for tax evasion and fraud. And he was caught in a sting, and he pleaded guilty to falsely reporting all the fish that he was catching. He sold them on the black market and took his ill-gotten gains overseas. But this week's story involves two of his boats, the Nemesis and the Dinah Jane. Both of them were docked in New Bedford Harbor, and they both sank early Monday morning, about 1 a.m. There was nobody on board either of the boats, so there was nobody injured. There was some oil that leaked. Divers went down this week and plugged up the spots where the fuel could leak out into the harbor. So there's a lot of questions, of course, and they really can't be answered just yet until they get the boats out of the water. So yesterday some work was done to lift the boats. The divers went into the water. It's off Homer's Wharf in New Bedford. The divers deployed these airbags that will be used to raise the boats, and they'll have a crane to stabilize them so they don't tip over. And it's all in about 25 feet of water. It's complex, and it can't just be done very quickly. We're told it takes about 8 to 10 hours to raise each boat because these boats were tied together. So they're tangled. The masts and riggings are together. If you see the boats in New Bedford Harbor, you can see that they're stacked very close together, and you can go from one to the other. So what happened, they think, because these two boats were tethered, is that one of the boats sank, and it pulled the other one down. You know, these are big scallopers. They're 65 feet long. They're made of steel. So when a boat fills with water, it can sink pretty quickly. And the Nemesis, one of the boats, was undergoing repairs, and it had been under work for about a year. And as you mentioned, the other boat, the Dinah Jade, that made headlines just recently, last month, after the authorities seized, I think it was about 120 pounds of scallops that were hidden on the boat. And, you know, authorities asked if there was any scallops left after they offloaded their legal 800 pounds. And, you know, the crew and everyone said, no, there's no scallops left. And they found 120 pounds. So, yeah, that's another one of the things that have happened here. So we'll be watching.
When do they think that's going to happen, Andy, the raising?
They started yesterday, and it could be finished today or Saturday. As I said, it takes about 8 to 10 hours to raise one of the boats, and it's because they're so close together and they have some specialized equipment, and they're doing it. So we'll be following that today, and you can find it at southcoasttoday.com.
Andy Tomolonis of southcoasttoday.com, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, we were just speaking about the blizzard of 78. We'll continue in the storm theme here. The stairs at Nauset Beach, which seem to get washed out yearly, are going to be replaced, this time with a path down to the beach.
Yeah, this is Nauset Light Beach on the Cape Cod National Seashore. And again, it seems like an annual replacement. I think one of our folks here tweeted out, you know, they get destroyed, replace, repeat. You know, it's one of those things that happens every year. They've basically decided at this point that they're not going to replace them. They're going to create this path down to the beach that's kind of more gradual. Did raise some concerns, at least with one East Ham selectman who said that it may exclude some people who may not be able to use that path from getting to the beach. But there are other beaches that are handicap accessible, and they see this as kind of the really only way to go, because they just, the expense of every year going in and replacing these stairs. But it is a larger trend, which is looking at how you deal with this constant state of erosion. And there's been talk about retractable stairs. I think they're going in that direction in another location, or whether you do something that's more natural like this. You know, there's retreat of parking lots that's going on, but, you know, probably a lot of things that back in 1978 when the erosion was happening then, they weren't necessarily thinking about. They were thinking that was kind of an anomaly, that was a once-in-a-lifetime storm, but now they're looking at these things happening every year, and they're saying, you know, the better idea is to move forward with something that you're not going to have to replace every single year.
Another story this week, your reporter Jeff Spillane detailing two town planning initiatives in Hyannis that are getting some attention. We talked a little bit about one of these last week.
Yeah, the Cape Town Plaza, people will know it as the Kmart Plaza on Route 132. The town's looking to include it in its regulatory agreement districts map, which would allow it to basically have some streamlined regulations and be able to develop it more quickly and easily. That was up for a public hearing and kind of went through pretty quickly at the town council meeting recently. Another change is this expanding of the growth incentive zone in Hyannis, and they're looking to expand it to include this 55-acre property at Scudder Avenue. There's the Resort and Conference Center at Hyannis and Twin Brooks Golf Course there. They're looking to include that in this growth incentive zone. There is a proposal. It's not officially a proposal, and one of the town council president was quick to point that out and say you shouldn't be speaking to a specific proposal because we don't have one in front of us. But generally, everybody understands that the Oceanside Performing Arts Center, which would be the home for the Cape Cod Symphony, wants to go in there and use that property as its future location. So including it in the growth incentive zone would, again, allow for a streamlined permitting process and probably make that project a little easier to manage. That was pushed off. They're going to have a planning board meeting on February 12th to discuss it. I guess that's Monday. And then the town council next week will take it up again. Town council has the final say on expanding that growth incentive zone, which includes a lot of Hyannis, and expanding it to include this. It's up for renewal in any case, and it's just probably a question of whether you expand it or you just renew it as is.
Meanwhile, in Sandwich, plans for an extensive recreation facility are moving forward.
Yeah, and intergenerational at that. This is a location where they want to put in a skate park, a tennis courts, and pickleball courts. And certainly the skate park is probably something for the younger folks out there. Pickleball courts is a sport that's gained a lot of popularity recently with the older demographic here on the Cape. It's like tennis a little bit, but it's different enough where you can really handle it if you're a little older and may not be able to move around as much as on a tennis court. But they're looking at this location next to where a new public safety complex is being built on Quaker Meeting House and Kituit Roads. It's a $1.9 million to $2.1 million project. They're looking for Community Preservation Act money. The one hitch is that the Community Preservation Committee in Sandwich doesn't have any money currently in its coffers to go towards this project, so the town would have to borrow it, do a 10-year bond, and it would have to be paid back from Community Preservation Act money, which comes in through a property tax surcharge and a statewide CPA trust fund. So it's one of these kind of forward-looking things that they're saying, this is worth doing, we're going to borrow, and we're going to go forward. So the committee voted Monday to approve a proposal to build this. And again, it has to go through some other machinations before it happens, but it's a step forward on this project.
Patrick, in the last minute we have left here, I want to touch on a nice story you had about a girl from Sandwich with a rare genetic disease and the efforts of her and her family to bring awareness to the condition.
Yeah, this is Bridget Ames, and she has PAX1-related syndrome. Her family didn't even know what it was for many years because it's in so few children. She's 9 years old right now. She's one of 70 children in the world who have been diagnosed with this genetic disease. And again, they've been raising awareness ever since they were able to figure out what it was and doctors were able to figure it out what it was. It's a really, really good story. And again, PAX 1 Awareness Day was declared and it was done here through the work of State Representative Randy Hunt, who had asked Governor Charlie Baker to declare Wednesday PAX 1 Awareness Day. That went forward, and again, they're just looking for more resources and more funding to look at this syndrome and look at ways to help people who have it.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve.
And our other contributors, we heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Bowling, the Nantucket Inquirer-Mirror, Casey Myers, Provincetown Banner, George Brennan, Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.